Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now, how are younger women hearing this Me Too moment? If we're in the midst of making some significant change on sexual harassment, and it can take a while for true change to settle in, it is millennial women, women in college and beyond, who will see the benefits of that. So I want to open the phone lines and hear from you this morning. If you're a woman under 40, in the workplace, just getting started with your career, still finishing your education, I want to know how this tumultuous discussion about sexual harassment is sounding to you. Is real change coming, do you think? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, it's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our national call-in show, Flyover on Sexual Harassment, by the way, you can listen to that, and that's at flyoverradio.org. Carla Altmaier is with us. She's co-founder of Healing to Action. It's an organization that helps workers end gender violence, and she's with us today from Chicago. And Carla, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Carrie. Good morning.
Karina Shikano is with us. She's a writer and author of You Play the Girl. We talked about the book, and now we're talking about this issue, and she's with us from L.A. And Karina, welcome back to the show. I'm so glad you could do this.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Karina, I was reading something that you wrote in October for Rolling Stone, and you argued then that the Harvey Weinstein accusations could bring about true and significant change to the culture. And here's what your lead to the article said. Someday we'll look back on the great Harvey Weinstein scandal of 2017 as the moment the worm turned on the patriarchy, at least for a while. It was the critical mass that did it. Okay, we're about 6 weeks, 7 weeks out from that moment. How does this look to you? Would you still write the same thing?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure that I would. I think that I'm still hopeful, but I do think that things, you know, as with any movement like this, things get a little bit more complicated as time goes by.
So why do you feel that way?
You know, I think always in something like this, there are unintended consequences that we still don't know how they'll play out.
Uh-huh. Are you worried about backlash, Karina? Is that what you're thinking about?
I think that's yeah. always a possibility, yeah.
Carla, are you concerned about that?
Well, what I think is that the Me Too moment and the beginning of this public dialogue is really an opportunity to begin a conversation that needs to be happening in our private spaces, in our homes, in our workplaces, and in schools, where we're not really translating what this moment means in our daily lives. And I think that's important to do because for many women, for many young women, the solutions have always been individualized, right? What do you do when this happens to you is the question that people have to answer, as opposed to really thinking about this as a structural inequity problem. And what can we do as a society collectively to begin to address this issue? So I do think that there will be a backlash as a result, because there have to be points in our society, again, whether it's having sex education in schools, having conversations in workplace and meaningful conversations with men and women to begin to then discuss misogyny and harassment to begin to break down those barriers of the problem.
Call here from Marie in Moorhead, Minnesota. Hi, Marie. How are you listening to this?
Hi. I am very concerned that, you know, due process is being subverted in this. I understand wanting to, you know, believe the women. I have been sexually assaulted 5 times throughout my life. 2 of the times were people I was related to. I just feel like, although I mean, kind of to quote you earlier, this is politics concerning the politicians that are involved. False accusations may be more rampant, and it's kind of more muddy in an issue. I just think that we can't just ignore due process and ruin somebody's career mm-hmm. based on accusations. I think that there definitely needs to be a no tolerance policy. However, we need to start at the policy level, and we can start making the changes in that way rather than ganging up as a mob and ruining someone's career based on accusations rather than following through with due process.
I hear you in this, Marie. Carla, we've had a guest with us for a couple of these discussions, and I'm always reminded, it's Ty Coleman from St. Kate's, and she talks about how uncomfortable it is to have these kinds of changes to a very embedded power structure happen this quickly. And it feels uncertain and kind of frightening. And I think I'm hearing that in this morning and in many of these discussions. What's that look like to you?
Well, I think that there's a couple of, you know, I understand the need for due process, right? I am a lawyer by training and have that I believe that everybody deserves that process. I think what we're seeing actually is this swift reaction in the media, in the public eye, has actually not been that swift. You know, you're looking at, for example, the Weinstein case, where there were years of sexual harassment lawsuits settled, right? And
right.
The problem not addressed. You're also looking at other actors like Kevin Spacey, for example, who had a history of sexually assaulting other people in the workplace and in the context of the workplace. And so it seems swift to people, but I think that we need to be reminded that the due process that was there was actually not working to hold people accountable.
Yeah, I was reading a tweet this morning from CBS, and they had a segment today about the more than a dozen current and former cadets in the military, in the Air Force Academy, that reported their sexual assaults to the Air Force Academy, only to then experience retaliation by their peers and their commanders. Karina, when I see that and I know how long this has been going on, I really hear Carla on, it feels fast, but it really isn't.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think, you know, this problem, the way that this problem unfolds in the workforce has, you know, we talk about the feeling of instability when we see someone apparently losing their job very quickly. But, you know, these actions have such great repercussions on other people's careers, women's careers, women who are just starting out, and can really,
right.
you know, have shaped so many lives and careers. So I don't think that, you know, these things were called open secrets before, which to me just means everybody knew about it and no one was going to do anything about it. And so maybe that's the one change that we're seeing that's making it seem faster.
Yeah. I mean, the upheaval in the women who were experiencing this in their lives and their careers and their identities was all happening, you know, behind the scenes. Nobody, for the most part, we didn't know that was happening. Now it's very public for the people who are accused and in some cases admitting to having done this. Call here from Claire in St. Paul. Hi, Claire. What's this feel
Hi.
Like to you? Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm just listening, and I feel at moments in these discussions, I feel hopeful. I feel like we're seeing some change. And then I'm listening to the discussion today about Moore and Trump, and then I feel doubtful. And I feel like I'm going back and forth on this kind of spectrum of emotions as a female, because there are swift changes, as you guys have spoke about, that make you go, oh, my gosh, this is serious. We're taking this seriously. And then there are these other examples where you see no change. And then you feel like, are we really moving forward here? Mm-hmm. And why does this apply to some and not others?
Oh, boy, you've really raised all the questions that I think are confusing in the moment. Carla, what would you say to that?
I think that those are questions that we're all grappling with now. And I think it's important to note that, again, you know, this is something that's happening in the public with people who have been able to have the resources to marshal support around them to hold people accountable. But the changes that we've seen have not been systemic. And what we're looking for is we're looking for systemic change. So that includes involving our schools in providing a proper and appropriate sex education and healthy relationship education. We're looking at families having the tools and resources to be able to facilitate these conversations. And we're also looking at workplaces, not just from the top down, but from the bottom up, right, where they need to be starting to address gender-based violence. I'm thinking about, you know, the fact that 50% of low-wage workers are actually between the ages of 16 to 24 years old. And when you consider that many of these workers are coming from, you know, families whose incomes fall below the federal poverty guidelines, and you recognize that people in the lowest income bracket are six times more likely to experience gender-based violence than people in the higher earning counterparts, then you're seeing an actual disconnect in terms of what the conversation around this issue is taking into consideration. So there are several workers that, even though they have been working for a really long time to try to hold people accountable, they have not been able to due to barriers like their immigration status, or maybe living in poverty and fearing retaliation, or maybe because they've experienced so much harassment in the past as a result of their gender identity or sexuality, that coming forward again and doing something to take action has serious consequences to their stability.
On Twitter here, a listener says, as a 33-year-old black woman, I'm optimistic that cisgendered heterosexual white women will see positive change. Sadly, the rest of us will continue to suffer under two or more forms of oppression. Change doesn't come quickly or often enough for us. Karina, I've heard this is the part of the multifaceted discussion that's happening as we see this unfold. Yes, women with power, often white women, may see the change. And Carla just alluded to this. What about the women who work for an hourly wage, don't have power in our economy or our culture? Have you been thinking about that? What does this mean for them?
Yeah, of course. And I think that, you know, one of the interesting things, just jumping off what Carla said, that I think I've been thinking a lot about what makes this movement sometimes a little bit confusing, or what makes us grapple with different emotions. And this is one of the areas. But I think that you know, this is a systemic problem, and it is a sort of bottom up problem. And one of the things that makes us uncomfortable or fearful at times is when we've seen this play out in the political arena, because politicians have so much power in determining kind of what resources get allotted to certain things, or, you know, how we deal with this stuff on a systemic level, more so than, say, you know, a boss in a business.
Yeah.
So I do think that, you know, as with everything, we, you know, the more marginalized the group, the fewer resources are generally available.
Conversation this morning, if you've just tuned in, taking note of how younger women are hearing this discussion, this unease and this sense of empowerment of what's happening on sexual harassment, the changes that are coming, the outing that's going on, what's happening inside companies and politics and entertainment and media. And I've asked two guests, Carla Altmaier with us from Healing to Action, and Karina Shikano, she's a writer and the author of You Play the Girl, to come listen to you and listen to this discussion and say, this is the generation that will benefit or not from the changes that may come from this Me Too moment. So I'm asking to hear from you. If you're a woman under 40, you're in the workplace, you've just started your career, you're still finishing your education. So I want to hear from you at all levels here. How does this tumultuous discussion about sexual harassment sound to you is real change coming? Maybe you're seeing it on your college campus. Maybe you're seeing it in the company that you just started at. Maybe you're seeing it in the company that you started. 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Allison says, as a 24-year-old woman, I'm following the Me Too news cycle closely, and I find the moment or movement rhetoric to be a waste of time. Every man accused of sexual misconduct being taken out of power. Is progress being made? To the phones to Yvonne in Robbinsville. Hi, Yvonne. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thank you.
What are you thinking?
Calling in, I don't think there's going to be a lot of change happening right now. I think we'll kind of see a little slowing of it, but I think eventually it'll get back to kind of where it was. I think the real change we're going to see is in a lot younger generations, like people in grade school and high school. They're going to see this. Their parents, like our younger generations, women, you know, 30, 40 years old, 20 years old, they're going to start talking to their children more. And then that's where the true culture is going to change in the mentality. Right now, these individuals that are committing these acts honestly probably don't feel like they're doing anything wrong or they yeah. don't reflect. You know, so I don't think we're going to see a lot of change happening right now or even coming very soon. I think it's going to come a lot later.
Karina, what do you think of that? I tend to agree with Yvonne. I think that's right. It's going to take a while.
Well, I do believe it'll take a while. But I also, you know, I think a lot about this because I'm in my 40s. And when I was young, you know, I was very riveted by the Anita Hill trial. And then later by, you know, the sort of spectacle of Monica Lewinsky. And
right.
I feel like both of those things really shaped my sense of sort of my place in the world as a woman. But I do remember that for me and for my friends and generationally, those things felt, you know, we didn't take it lightly. Mm. And it didn't go unobserved. And you know, the Anita Hill hearings kind of famously launched the Riot Girl movement, or were very closely associated with third wave feminism. And Rebecca Walker, I think, coined the phrase third wave feminism in response to watching Anita Hill on television and feeling like she had to do something. So, you know, I do believe that these moments of sort of these moments do a lot to raise consciousness, but I do think that that what really needs to happen is systemic institutional change. I think this is, you know, very rooted in our power structures.
You know, Carla, I've been thinking a lot about Anita Hill. I'm glad Karina brought this up because I remember it too. As a young television reporter, I thought, this is the change. This is going to happen. And a lot of more women were elected to Congress, and more women began the climb up through, you know, corporate America. But what I now look back and realize is behaviors on the part of men really didn't change. They just maybe went deeper underground, but they were still happening because look at the stories that women are telling about the last 20 years of their lives. It tells me that not as much changed as I naively thought it would. What's your sense of it?
I agree. I agree that, you know, my sense of this is that one of the, you know, it's funny, when Anita Hill, when the Anita Hill case came out, I was really young, and I actually don't remember that. What I remember more is Monica Lewinsky and just kind of seeing that men's behavior hasn't changed over this time is very sad because those were opportunities for those conversations to happen. I do think that Me Too is actually beginning that process where men are starting to question. Now, I know that there's been the conversation of a backlash where that men are afraid to then engage with women. But that what that really means is that that is an opportunity to start that conversation, that there need to be spaces where men have this dialogue around the issue of gender-based violence and really figure out what does it mean for them as a man in their place in the world to be supportive to women's leadership, to be supportive to women in general and to be allies? And what does that actually mean for them? Does that mean that, you know, does it mean that if they're standing in a room hearing a joke, a sexualized joke, should they say something? Should they speak up? And what is their role in those dynamics?
Deborah called to say, I think there's so many powerful forces in place to keep things as they are that I'm not optimistic. When you look at issues of race, harassment, even Occupy Wall Street, there's a big effort to suppress all that. I don't see much hope that white men will give up power. Diane called to say, I have a 16-year-old daughter who works on the Minnesota Youth Council, finalizing a statement on sexual harassment. That's good to know, Diane. They're concerned. A lot of them didn't know how much women had to endure over the years. And to David in St. Cloud. Hi, David. Glad you called. Tell me how you're thinking about this.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My biggest concern that I was curious about your input on is that my biggest concern is that there will be a certain amount of public fatigue, that while we're debating about what to do, one side says this, one side says that, one side says women's voices need to be heard, we need to do something about this, change this on the systemic level. Another says, well, what if these men didn't do it? And on and on and on. Mm. And then eventually society will move on and we'll look back at this issue, even as big as it is, 5, 10, 20 years from now and go, wow, that was a big deal. Nothing really happened about it.
Yeah, David, I hear you. I've thought about that too. And as we watched the Harvey Weinstein thing occupy the headlines, I felt this kind of sense of despair. Like, there was a lot of coverage about it, and then it kind of faded. But what I hadn't anticipated was that that would be an empowering moment for more women to say, and me in my work, and me in my life. Karina, I don't know, maybe we're underestimating the staying power of this.
You know, at risk of sounding like I'm, you know, saying both sides, because this is a kind of back and forth, it has been kind of a back and forth debate lately, I do believe that this time it does feel different. I mean, I sort of stand by that, in that the critical mass has made it seem like this isn't just going to go away right away. And while I agree that maybe the way that it's framed or the way that it's talked about, we need to think about that too, so that we don't risk a kind of greater backlash or public fatigue. I do think that this is a moment that has gotten big enough, and a movement that's gotten big enough that it's a lot harder to put it entirely back in the bottle.
Yeah. I'll say here for listeners that at the moment in New York City, a group of President Trump's accusers are speaking out at a press conference right now. And so that's a developing story, and you'll hear more about that later. To Michaela in Anoka. Hi, Michaela. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Tell me how you hear this, what you've been thinking about.
Yeah, I'm 22, and I recently graduated from college. I'm hoping to go into a political career. So all of these allegations have, you know, made me think a lot about what that might look like. And I think they've been pretty surprising to me to realize what's still going on. I think I was kind of raised to believe that a lot of this was in the past. And it's been pretty disheartening even to hear reactions from my peers. And, you know, I don't know how hopeful I am, because a lot of my peers are kind of not taking it seriously or still making jokes and things like that. And so I'm curious about how this change will actually take place and if those deeply rooted systems that we've been talking about can actually change.
Michaela, if you don't mind, I'm also going to ask Carla about how maybe in those discussions that you hear, you might intervene, might be too strong of a word, but you might step in and say something persuasive, you know, for your peers to take it seriously. It might be a valuable moment. Carla, would you make a suggestion on that?
Of course. And I just want to thank all, you know, the caller and all the other callers who've called to be able to express what's going on. I think interventions differ depending on the circumstances, right? If we're seeing a circumstance where physical harm is imminent, then perhaps we take an intervention stance where it's more about protecting the survivor rather than, you know, trying to come up with a moment of deep reflection and thought for the person who's committing the act of violence. But I think in a situation where we're hearing someone say a joke or make a comment, I think it's important to call them out and say, why are we talking about it in this way? I think there are many times when people can talk about it from a place that impacts them and say, would you be talking about this if this was, you know, how would you like people to talk about this if this talk about you in this way, if, you know, or hearing them talk about it. But I think those are short-term intervention strategies and conversation. I think then there's also the second set of intervention strategies that really require more meaningful and deep dialogue. And so maybe sitting with the person and just talking with them and asking them, what have you been thinking about the Me Too moment? And I think for a lot of people, the reactions could be coming from a place of fear. We're really not understanding what does this mean, or not understanding what what actually harassment means in their interpersonal interactions.
Kim says the biggest issue is that speaking out against injustice needs to be a long process. It's important that we stay with it. It's not just one issue. It requires women to speak out more often. And then on Twitter here, Nick says, men need to do more to call out other men on their misogynistic behavior and rhetoric. And also, in many cases, women need to do more to support victims of sexual offense. Too much victim blaming and shaming, and it stems from patriarchy pitting women against one another. Karina, you know, I have to say that this, this idea that women are competitive. You know, I hate that trope. Oh, women are too competitive to really support one another, because I don't think that's true. But I do think more visible support of one another could be valuable in this moment. I'd be interested to hear what you make of that.
I agree with both of those things. And I was thinking, too, during Michaela's call, when she was saying, you know, she was brought up to believe that all of this stuff was in the past and was surprised to see that it wasn't. I this was something I grappled with a lot in my book. When I was growing up, I also felt that I was told that this was all in the past, and I was surprised to learn that it wasn't the case, you know, during the Anita Hill trial and later.
Yeah.
So part of the way I think that patriarchy, like, perpetuates certain narratives that kind of keep us having discussions in certain ways or looking at things in certain ways is by pitting generations against each other. And it's one thing that kind of keeps happening, I think, with women, with feminism, where each new generation or each new iteration is sort of like, you know, kind of looks back and says, oh, well, we're doing it differently now, or this is different now.
Right.
And I think there's a danger in that, because there's a splitting that happens. And, you know, one of the things that I talked about in my book is, you know, the traditional fairy story, which is a story that we kind of keep seeing in Hollywood, pits the older woman against the younger woman.
Right.
And aligns the younger woman with the patriarch. And this is just the traditional princess story, the evil witch who did it, you know, who's powerful and evil and tends to be the villain. And I think this is definitely a story that we need to start telling differently and understanding differently, and that it is important for us to come together in this moment.
I'm really glad you've brought this back to how we tell stories about who we are. And that begins at a very young age for kids, and they're starting to form their identities using those stories. And Therese says here on Twitter, being not only a mother, but a single mother raising a boy gives me an opportunity to model what good men are, how they act and what they do, and how men treat women. Therese, I'm really glad you had a chance to write in on Twitter. And to Erica in Minneapolis. Hi, Erica. I'm so glad you waited. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
What'd you want to say?
Well, I was just hearing this conversation has made me think about, like, my own experience. I'm currently 20, but I'm 6'4",
mm-hmm.
And so by being so tall, it's really always attracted a lot of attention from men and women. But because of the Me Too movement, I think I've really been inspired to be able to discern what might be an inappropriate comment about my height and say something to the person and be able to confront a man instead of just being quiet.
What do you think you'd say? I imagine you've been thinking about that.
I mean, I've had it where sometimes I'll get a nickname, like they'll call me Legs, and they'll just follow me around and call me Legs. And I think hearing that kind of thing, I ask why they would, it's become more of like, I confront by asking them why they would ask that,
yes.
Why they would call me that.
I mean, instead of just taking it, right? Turning around and having something to say about it.
Exactly. And I mean, it almost makes them uncomfortable enough to realize that maybe it's inappropriate.
Right, right. Glad to have the call. Let me know what happens the first time you do it. Okay. Carla, and I think this goes back to where we started with this change is it feels intense and sudden, but it's not, as I think all three of us have agreed. But even in the moment, small things like what Erica has just said she's going to do, I think can make a pretty big difference in your own life, educationally, culturally. What would you say?
I agree. I think that strategy that Erica mentioned in terms of being able to say, what are my boundaries? What do I want is important. I think we've always measured violence by how the patriarchy has measured it, right? And I think we are talking about, you know, I heard Karina mention the story of the girl, but there's also been the story of men and what is violence, right? Youth are taught that violence is being pulled in a dark alley and being raped.
Right.
They're not really thinking about what their behavior, how their behavior is impacting other people. And I think something that we're doing with our organization is we're really working to create that dialogue with other survivors to then find meaningful solutions that are grounded in their realities and experiences.
Carla, Karina, thanks so much for the really valuable insight and your voices on this. Really good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
I want to say thank you to everybody who called to weigh in. Sometimes when I put out a call like, okay, I want to hear from women under 40, I'm not sure who's going to respond. And you did. Full phone lines. So more conversations coming. Thanks.